as well of course as colleagues from cabinet and policy and analysts. The Economic Development Department has been hosting a series of policy platforms. They're informal conversations. They bring together some leading thinkers, some fresh evidence, and an opportunity. So some weeks ago, we invited a few eminent economists from the UK and France to come and talk to us about the global economic crisis. And thereafter, together with Minister Quinty, we hosted a policy platform on rural economic development. And what has been characteristic of both of those is the desire by South Africans to debate, to talk, to reflect on the policy challenges that we face. And so we decided today to take a very important contemporary challenge, that of income inequality, and to ask two questions. What are the facts and what are the policy implications? The facts are what our speakers will place before us. The policy implications are what I think you can contribute to the thinking of government. Now, income inequality is not a uniquely South African challenge. Part of what you will hear today is the relative position of South Africa against, let's say, a Brazil in the last number of years. But policy debates globally are characterized by a deep concern in the public sector at rising income inequality in many parts of the world. One of our speakers has examined the case of South Africa, and he will put to us both the facts and in some cases the relationship between the different facts on income inequality and poverty. And I in particular feel that it's great that we can give this public platform to Professor Harun Bora. But we also want it a bit of a global sense, so that while we examine our reality, we can see what are the broader things. And we invited Mazlum Mahmoud, who is a senior technical specialist at the International Labour Organization, to come and talk to us and be a respondent, if you like, to Professor Bora's paper. The ILO's work, the work of economists in the G20, the World Bank, and other institutions have all shown one key issue, that the last 2 to 3 decades of economic growth has been associated in many countries with rising income inequality. The ILO, for example, produced last year its first ever global wage report. And what that report shows is that across countries, rich and poor, income inequality was a key public policy concern, in particular rising income inequality. And I hope that what we can achieve out of today is to have some reference to the facts, some understanding of the causes of income inequality in South Africa, a common recognition that this is a serious national challenge, and a few ideas on how best we can deal with it. We'd like to keep the presentation relatively short and focused so that we can get the best value of our two speakers from the question and answer session. And so may I then immediately invite and introduce to you Harun Bora, who teaches at the University of Cape Town. He has a very eminent CV and one area of recent work that has elicited quite a bit of public comment is his work on income inequality. Harun, this is great to have you here. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Minister. Suffering with bronchitis means that the only presentation we make is if the Minister asks you to make the presentation. And I've cancelled both of the events. So, you'll pardon me if there's a lot of coughing and pauses in between while I take a water break, but I think the adrenaline of this area will keep me going. Ironically, the research program that this involves, which is an analysis of broadly the linkage between poverty, growth and inequality, is not an entirely new one that we've embarked on, and it's yielded a series of outputs in different ways, and this is just one aspect of it. And what I'll try and do is just take you through some of the key results from the paper, and like any good economist, I hide behind figures and tables and numbers, but I'll try and tell a story around that. Now, what is interesting to us is if we go back to 94 and we look at changes in the economy, one thing that does stand out pre the recession, of course, is consistent and positive economic growth of the order of 2.53% over the period, right? So you can take an average annualized figure. The question for us here and the question we pose in the paper is what has been the impact of growth on social welfare generally? And our entry point into understanding social welfare is to look at poverty and inequality. Just to pause here very quickly and to emphasize that the focus here is on income poverty and income inequality. So we don't concentrate on what is called the social wage or assets or services. That is, in fact, has been done in another paper that we worked on. So the focus here is purely on what has been the change in terms of people's incomes or expenditures over the period. Now, why this paper is quite important is because we had the release, you'll see that fourth bullet point there, the release of something called the 2005 IEF, which is the Income and Expenditure Survey. Now, the Income and Expenditure Survey, you may or may not know, comes out every 5 years, but it's really, really important. And it's the only instrument we have available to accurately estimate poverty and inequality shifts. You cannot use the census, you cannot use the labor force surveys, you can only use the income and expenditure survey for various reasons to estimate impacts on poverty and inequality in the society. So it's a key data set that comes out every 5 years. And so one of the debates we've been having with Stats SA as a side is to in fact increase the frequency of the data set. So, I have two key aims. One is to look at what has been the impact as a consequence of this positive growth period since 94, what has been the impact on household poverty, right? So what have been the poverty and inequality, if you like, shifts in this 95-2005 period? And then secondly, to nuance the argument a bit more and to look at the interactions between growth, poverty, and inequality. And they instrumental to understanding how the benefits of growth may or may not be translated into reduced poverty. I'll skip the data and the methodology. So I promise you there'll be numbers, and if you permit me to take you through some of the numbers. Here's the headline result, right, which is to look at something called, if you look at that table, it says the headcount index, right? And the headcount index is calculated as a proportion of households that are deemed poor, and the table has two sections to it, a 322 rand a month poverty line, and you'll see a second section which says 174 rand a month poverty line. Those are high and low poverty lines that we use. So I'll come back to where the poverty line should be and so on. But the key result, the key two results, if you like, is that from the period 95-2005, you saw the proportion of households that were poor declining from 52%, right, to 1995, that's the total, right, to about 49%. Does everybody see that? So I know there are lots of, so let me just see if I can work the mouse. Okay, so there we go. 52% was the 1995, that's the proportion of households that were poor. In 1995, a decade later, it declined. That's a key result, right? It says that over the first decade of democracy, we saw a decline in household poverty. But you could say, isn't that poverty line too high? Well, that's why I've got another poverty line, the lower one, the 174 rand a month poverty line. And guess what happens there? The proportion of households that were poor was 31% in 95. That declines to 24%. So in fact, amongst the ultra-poor, there's a larger reduction in poverty in the first decade of democracy. So, in the context of this debate between or amongst economists about what happened to poverty in the first decade of democracy, we have a clear result here, and it's statistically significant and so on, that in the first decade of democracy, positive economic growth saw a decline in poverty levels. Right? Positive economic growth resulted in a decline in household poverty levels. Very key result. Right? And it's a key result, as I'll show later, because economic growth is necessary, right, but not always sufficient for poverty reduction. So, if you look carefully, you'll see I've disaggregated these results by race of household head. So, you'll see there that even for African, colored, Asian, and white households, more importantly for African households, the result is also true. So, you see a reduction in African household poverty as well. For those of you who really like the numbers, the poverty gap ratio asks the question, how have the poor, relatively speaking, fared? And there's a reduction as well. So the poverty gap ratio shows a reduction in relative poverty. So that's reinforcing the early results. What if you did it by a different cut? What if you looked at what happened to gender of household head? Well, there again, okay, let's just take you through. There's your headline, the 52 and 49. There again, notice for female-headed households, there's a decline from 66 to 62. For male-headed households, there's a decline from 46 to 39. So irrespective of the gender of the household head, right, there's a decline in household poverty. Note, however, right, just note the discrepancy. It's quite phenomenal. The discrepancy between, in 2005, what this means, the 61.56, means that 61.56 of all female-headed households were poor. Right? That's an astounding number. Compared to only 40% of male-headed households. Right? So the notion of the gender dimension of poverty still holds true, despite this reduction. Right? This is, I told you, fancy graph, okay? But this is quite an important graph. And what it does is, if you take these two black lines that I've drawn here, let me just find them off, these two lines represent those two poverty lines I showed you, right? And what I'm drawing are things called cumulative distribution functions, but essentially draws the distribution of income for 95 and 2005. For reduction in poverty to happen, you want the 95 curve to be above the 2005. For reduction in poverty to happen, 95 must be above 2005, which is what you see. These two black lines are poverty lines. So, in other words, if I chose a poverty line in between here, between these two, you'll see that the yellow line, 95, is still above the red line. This is a very important tool because what it allows us to do is analyze poverty changes without a dependence on poverty lines. And you all know the debates that we've had for the last 3 years about an official poverty line. So the footnote I'll put for policy discussion is we still don't have an official poverty line, right? At least an analysis like this allows you to abstract from a poverty line because it shows you that for any feasible poverty line, the yellow line, right, is above the red line, right? In other words, poverty has declined irrespective of any feasible poverty line you may want to choose. And that's seems like a basic result, but it's actually a very powerful result because often your poverty results are questioned on the basis of the choice of your poverty line. That's just to show you that if you look at African-headed households, you'll see the yellow line is everywhere above the red line. Same story. Doesn't matter what poverty line you choose, up to 1,000 rand, right? You see right at the end there, that 1,000 rand, you still get higher African, lower African poverty in 2005. Relative to 95. Same with the gender of household head. Okay? I'm happy to take questions on these afterwards in terms of detail and so on. Now, before I switch to the inequality results, let me contextualize them. So we've looked at this notion that growth will see a reduction in poverty. I've done the African and the gender-headed household story, and we have a nice positive story that growth has seen a reduction in poverty. What often happens, though, is if you think of a distribution of income, what will happen is as growth happens, and there's some poverty line there, as growth happens, people should filter above the poverty line. But sometimes what also happens, and very often what happens, is that people above the poverty line also start filtering up. Everybody with me? And that's another way of saying, sorry, I'm switching to student mode. That's another way of saying that your distribution begins to stretch. So in fact, what often happens in the growth process is that the gains from poverty reduction are stolen by inequality increases. The gains from poverty reduction are stolen from inequality increases. And that's a common result in most developing countries. And we'll revisit this theme. So one of the things we really want to look at is, okay, poverty's gone down, but what's happened to inequality? And the measure we use is something called the Gini coefficient. Everybody's aware of it. It's a standard measure of income inequality that ranges between 0 and 1. The closer that value is to 1, the more unequal the society is. To give you a descriptor, the U.S. for industrialized countries is considered relatively unequal, and the U.S.'s Gini is about 0.4. The Scandinavians are considered to be a fairly equal society. Their Gini is about 0.3. South Africa, historically, has always been one of the most unequal societies in the world, right? And so our Gini has always been relatively high at about 0.6, 0.63, 0.64, along with Brazil. Now, the second thing we know, apart from South Africa being a highly unequal society, is that Gini's, unlike poverty measures, don't change by that much. It takes fairly big events for Gini coefficients to change by significant amounts. So I really wouldn't, my a priori, if you like, before I do the data analysis, I wouldn't have expected the Gini in South Africa to have changed dramatically. Okay. So that's our Gini coefficient result. That total figure, that bold at the bottom there, is, I'm trying to find the mark, 0.64 was our Gini at the beginning of 95, or mid-95. 0.64 is what we expect, right? But look at what's happened to that Gini. It's gone up. Now, in Gini terms, right, that's a huge leap. To go from 0.64 to 0.69, and it's statistically significant, is almost unheard of, right? It's highly unusual to see a Gini change that dramatically. Now, there's some results using other data sets which place the Gini in 0.7, 0.71, 0.72 territory, and that's incredibly scary. So, if you like, the most depressing results from this paper and in the presentations we often make is that what you've seen is a growth process deliver a rising level of income inequality, right? One of the most unequal societies, and the minister used a nice phrase, one of the most unequal developing societies has now probably become the most unequal developing country. And that's a correction on previous quotes about South Africa being the most unequal in the world. Technically, that's not entirely true. For countries that we have all the data and regular data, for countries that that haven't experienced shocks such as famine or war or massive growth such as China, we are probably one of the most unequal societies in the world. And certainly for developing or industrializing countries, we are the most unequal. And I say that because over the same period, Brazil's Gini has gone down. So if you wanted a result that's deeply worrying about our growth process, it's this result, and I'll tease it out further. This is another fancy graph, it's the Lorenz curve, just reflecting the fact that if you look at the white inequality levels, that's the green and the blue over the decades, they're far lower than African inequality levels. Now, one thing that we can do with inequality analysis is to ask the following question: what is driving this change in inequality? And the way that's probably the easiest to understand is if you think of urban and rural inequality. And China's often a nice example, right? That with the growth process, what's happened in China is that inequalities between urban and rural areas has grown, right? And so what you find is that as a contributor to overall inequality, urban and rural area inequality, right, that between group inequality has contributed to overall inequality, as opposed to what we call within group inequality. So as opposed to inequalities within urban areas or within rural areas. Does that make sense? Right? So you can have a within group dynamic or between group dynamic. So what you can do is ask the question, which of those two forces are more important, between or within group? And there's this thing called the Tile Index, right? There's a physicist called Tile, he used entropy theory, and the economist stole it, and made economists look clever, that's actually a physicist. And his measure allows us to apply this to any group that you want. So it doesn't have to be location. And what we did here was to look at racial groups. So we asked the question, just think of it logically, this distribution of income that's been changing, the inequality that's been becoming worse over time, has it been driven by inequality within the African group, within the white group, or is it inequality driven by differences between Africans and whites? Does that make sense? Right? And so most of the results we've seen thus far, right, have shown that the within group component, that 53%, that 53% has been dominant, right, and growing. If you look at results prior to 95, it's within group inequality that's been driving overall inequality. So it was about 40% a decade and a half ago, and it suddenly went up, right? And that's because of the rising black middle class, public sector jobs, all the stuff that we know, right? Black economic empowerment, and all that sees inequality within the African distribution growing, and that contributes to overall inequality. Here's now change, which was worrying. And so worrying that I would consider it a provisional result, right? That the between group component, that is inequality between Africans and whites, went from 47%, that figure there, right, to 50%. So in other words, overall inequality, right, is growing as a consequence, or has been driven by, this overall inequality increase is being driven by inequality between Africans and whites. And that's a deeply worrying result. And it's a provisional result. Because it's so unusual and it's so counter to other analytical work, not in the same data period, but just for all the other trend analysis that we've done pre-95, it shows a different result. And that for me speaks to issues that I'm not an expert on, but speaks to issues around social stability and so on. So, I think I've got about 10 more minutes. Bring it all together. We've looked at poverty, look at inequality. Let's look at this relationship between growth, poverty, and inequality, because we know, right, as I said at the outset, that growth is a necessary but not sufficient condition for poverty reduction. Right? And in fact, the fancier work which we've done in other papers shows that the higher the impact on inequality, so more inequality increases you have, the lower your impact on poverty will be. That's just a fact of how the dynamics work. And we use something called the growth incidence methodology, which I'll explain, to examine these interactions. So here's this thing called the growth incidence curve. And before I launch into it, let me just give you a quick, again, switching to lecturer mode, if you don't mind. What you do here is look at the period 95-2005 again, right? But I'm interested in the poorest to the richest households in the society, the poorest to the richest. So you can imagine if I take this, if all of us in this room represent the entire society, right? I take the person who's the poorest in 95, and then the person who's the next poorest, and the next poorest, and so on, and I line them up, right? I then go to 2005, and I have the same group of people, but of course you've all switched, so it doesn't matter who you are. I then go and ask, well, what is the poorest person's income again in 2005? And the second poorest, right? And all I'm graphing then is the percentage change in their income. I'm asking the question, what has been the percentage change in household income of the poorest household right through to the richest? Does that make sense? So if you want a growth process that's going to be beneficial to the poor, what should that curve look like? That curve should be really high, right? That curve should have really high values at the bottom end for the poorest. Because your income, if you're right at the bottom, should be 10-15%, and it should be declining all the way like this. Because then the rich must be getting, who are down here, should be getting less than the poor. Does that make sense? So that's the growth incidence curve. Standard methodology, right? What this is the growth incidence curve for South Africa. And there's a storyline here which we developed, right? And it goes as follows, that over the period 1995 to 2005, the rich have gained. So if you think of the 80th percentile upwards, the rich have gained enormously out of the growth process, right? And that speaks to the rising income inequality. And they've gained, if you like, more, if you think of right at the top end of the 95th or the 90th percentile, from here onwards, they've gained more than anybody in the society, okay? In a distribution sense and in income sense, right? But notice also that the poor, those at the bottom end of the distribution, have also gained. And the storyline we develop is that over this growth process, the revenue coffers, of course, filled up rapidly, right? And coincidentally or deliberately or by a matter of policy, if you like, intent, you saw a redistribution of the revenue base, right, to the bottom end of the distribution in the form of social grants. So social grants, in fact, maintain this growth trajectory in the following form, right, where you have revenue being generated at the top end through the growth process, and then they channel back to the bottom end of the distribution. That's the two parts of the second part of the story. The third part is what told the minister John Ledeschenze refers to as the missing middle. And that's sort of from the 20th percentile right through to about the 75th, 78th percentile. And you see this rapid decline across the distribution. The missing middle represents blue-collar workers. Now, again, it's a theory in search of evidence, because I don't have enough evidence to tell you who's in that missing middle. But you know, more or less in the middle of that distribution would be blue-collar workers, public sector workers, think nurses, teachers, and so on, right? Those individuals have certainly not gained from the growth process. So, one of the sidebar comments I always make is that it's not surprising that you see such high strike activity. It's almost a reflection of the fact that you've lost out from the growth process. That's the growth process for Africans. What you notice is it's just a sharper, more angular version of the national figure with rapid increases at the top end of the distribution. I'll leave that percentile for now. To drive home the point about why it's possible that between group inequality may be driving overall inequality, is I graph here very simply the percentage changes in income, but for only the rich, so the 80th percentile onwards by race. So guess which is the purple line? White household. Right? So the top end of the distribution, right, you see white households' incomes, that should be 2005, not 2995. White households' incomes have grown on average about 13%, right? But it's 12.5% for the 80th, and it reaches a peak in the 99th of about 14%. And that's African households at the bottom, which is 6.5, peaking at about 9.5. So in other words, even amongst the top end of the distribution, you've seen the racial differentiation, where African households have gained and their incomes have grown far less than white households. Right? And that's statistically the fact. So no matter what one says about access to public sector tenders or BEE and so on, if you wonder a reflection of if you change the if you de-racialize the top end of the distribution in terms of accessing benefits from growth, well, the answer is statistically, answer is no. So what's happened at the bottom end? And I've got about two more slides. At the bottom end, we focus on the story about social grants, and that's just one angle. We could go to the top end and look at BEE and that sort of thing, but we don't. We look at how important social grants have actually been in terms of dissipating the possible maldistribution impact of growth. But put differently, social grants have been critical in ensuring that the Gini didn't go up even more. Right? And some of the other work we've done shows that the Gini is even higher when you exclude social grants. Right? So the social grants have been critical. And you see here stories that you all know very well, better than me, how social grant access has increased, right? With most of it being driven by the child support grant. Has it increased across the distribution? Yes, it has, right? Look at this, 43% of all households in the bottom end of the distribution, so the first decile, right? The bottom 10% of households, 43% had access to a social grant in 1995. Look at the figure in 2005, 65%. Right? That's that point versus that. And if you look at it across the entire distribution, everybody in the distribution, but mainly the bottom end, has gained from social grants. That just reinforces our point that that growth incidence curve at the bottom end that you see, where you see those growth in incomes being so high, it's mainly because of social grants coming back. And as a proportion of income, they've also grown. So in other words, it's not just the value, it's not just the number of grantees in terms of access rate, but look at the proportion of household income that grants were in 1995. That's that blue cross there. The first decile is about 35%. It goes up to about 55% a decade later. So even, if you like, in qualitative terms, as a proportion of household income, social grants are coming right in there, right, to support the growth process. So, what are some of the key conclusions? Well, we've seen a significant decline in absolute and relative poverty levels, right, for African and female-headed households. And very crucial for poverty analysis, right, is that the shift is invariant to the choice of poverty line. Countries have huge debates about the choice of the poverty line, right? And results can change. I think India's election, right, the BJP made a critical mistake because they trusted poverty results based on an incorrect poverty line and lost the rural area. So poverty lines are crucial, and the fact that it's invariant to our choice of poverty line is not incidental. Income inequality, just to stress the significant increase, that is unusual. And deeply worrying, and the fact that the between group story is there. Just a final point, apart from our growth incidence, is you've seen absolute profile growth. So in other words, growth has been poor across, has been positive across the distribution, but there's a story about the missing middle and then the rising incomes at the top end of the distribution. And the sort of paper leaves the question, which is, we've got a growth trajectory at the moment that's built on gains at the top end through the organic growth process that provides gains to people at the top end who are well networked or well educated and so on. And the state then uses the revenue base to buttress those at the top end through social, at the bottom end through social grants. The question is that sustainable? And secondly, is that necessarily desirable as a growth and development trajectory? Okay, thanks very much.
Well, thank you very much to Varun for that. Now, that snapshot of South Africa, what's the international evidence, and what does an outsider who's done work in developing countries make of the evidence that we're examining yesterday? So for that reason, we've invited Muazzam Mahmoud. I've indicated he's a senior technical specialist at the ILO, but he's done work in a number of countries that are grappling with similar issues: China, Vietnam, Pakistan, but also in Brazil, a number of African countries, including Mozambique, Zambia, Egypt, and the Sudan. So I'd like to ask Muazzam then to address us, to share with us a little bit the thoughts from his work and from the experience of the ILO. You have the floor.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure indeed for the ILO to be invited into this August house and to address such a momentous issue, which is poverty and income inequality. I don't want to go into an academic set of issues, because this is a fascinating paper that Professor Borat and his colleagues have written, and it's a very rigorous pursuit of trying to follow from the first poverty, then inequality, then some of the factors underlying it, some of the ethnic issues underlying it, then some of the distributional issues underlying it. What I would like to do in the 10 to 15 minutes that I have is address what I think are the important implications coming out of this paper. First of all, I think the good news is something which is tremendous, because you do not always have good news. In the first 10 years of post-independence development and growth, poverty has come down, and that is no mean achievement, and I think it is something that must be lauded significantly. That has not always been the case in parts of Africa, where we have to go, where we are challenged, and see that. So I think that is a very important impact of policy. That's the good side of the story, the good message. We have to always be confronted with the challenge, and the challenge that Professor Borath has pointed out to us today is that on the one hand, while poverty has dropped, inequality has gone up. And as he points out, it takes a significant effort in changes in consumption and income earned for inequality to increase, especially in 10 years. And from an already very high base, which is very significant, the base is already a Gini of 0.6. It is significantly higher than many parts of the world. I can't hesitate, but point to one very disturbing table, which Professor Borath has not alluded to here, but which is in his appendix, which actually is very worrying even more, just on the poverty aspect. I know that poverty has dropped, but think about it. We have two poverty lines, a higher poverty line, 300, and a lower poverty line of 100. There should be fewer people trapped by the lower poverty line. There should be more people trapped by the higher poverty line. However, what is disturbing in Appendix Table 1, sorry to refer to the table, is that if we look at it by race, all the other races, this follows, that the higher poverty line traps more people, the lower poverty line traps less people. But for Africans, it is the other way around. And that is very disturbing. The lower poverty line traps a significantly higher proportion, a 2 to 3% higher proportion. That means that extreme poverty is very high amongst that ethnic group, amongst Africans. That is a very disturbing result, and one which is, as I'm saying, it doesn't follow for any of the other races. So pardon me for pointing it out, but that is a very disturbing result. Even while poverty has been doing well, even while the other tables show it, but this is upsetting. It is equally upsetting for the other underprivileged group, which is gender. The same thing happens, that for men, more men should be trapped by the higher poverty line, less men should be trapped by the lower poverty line. The same result follows. For women, more women get trapped under by the lower poverty line. Again, it shows, if you like, I'm not trying to split hairs, I am trying to point out it is a major indicator of the depth of poverty for both female-headed households as well as for Africans. But let's move away from just the discussion. I think it's a very succinct, very rigorous pursuit of empirical evidence of looking at households. I want to move towards the relationship between poverty and inequality. And that is, I'm sure if Professor Borath had more time, that is the point that he was ending at. That is perhaps important for policy and for us to consider here. Why is it that we've got these two results moving in opposite directions? A good, poverty coming down, a bad, well, let's take it for the moment. I don't want you to prejudge the issue, but obviously if income inequality is becoming so concentrated, let's for the moment say that it's a bad. So a bad, that income inequality is worsening. What could account for it? Clearly, let's just take a set of possibilities. If
if everything is hunky-dory, if poverty is coming down and inequality is coming down, we know there are two factors at work here. One is growth. People enter the workplace, earn an income, and that income is reflected in the income distribution. The other is what Professor Borat referred to and has investigated, is the redistribution of income. That a part of that income earned is then given to the less privileged, those who are being trapped below a poverty line. So, two things at work here. Obviously, if both things are good, if poverty is going down, inequality is going down, then the growth effect and the redistribution effect, if you like, are both pulling in the same direction. Great. Equally, if both things were bad, if poverty was going up and inequality was going up, we would say that yes, we've got these two forces, the growth effect and the redistribution effect, working badly. Now we've got this curious hybrid. We've got poverty coming down, inequality going up, and while it is difficult to say without further empirical investigation, but clearly the redistribution effect is responsible for the poverty result. It would seem to be the greater probability of that. And the growth effect is responsible for the worsening income inequality. I realize I'm not allowed to make that statement, but the greater probability is that. If that is so, then it would be interesting to see that if we, clearly what is happening is that the lower end of the distribution is not sharing in the growth. We need to examine this further. I'm merely stating it, but I think it would be important as a continuation, Professor Borat, of your very good work to see, is all of society participating in growth, or are some deciles participating in growth and some deciles not participating, or some groups not participating in growth? Because clearly, and in the way to examine it would be if we were to remove the redistribution effect and just see what is the pure growth effect. If we remove the grants, the social transfers, what is the growth effect? Now, the policy implication for that would be worrying because, as Professor Borat pointed out, he's worried about, is that you cannot have a sustainable growth trajectory just based upon growth for the higher or some deciles and not all of the population participating in that growth process. Because then eventually the burden of the social transfers will become so high that it will swamp the entire growth process. In theory, we're headed in that direction. So I think it is important to see to what extent it is that the poverty reduction is just based upon the transfers and to what extent the income inequality is based upon the growth effect. That would be critical. What leads me to refer to an outside variable here, and perhaps Professor Borat may want to go down that direction, is to relate the income to employment. Now, I come from an organization which has to be concerned with employment. We think it is fundamental, and of course the quality of that employment, but we can't be helped but struck by the fact that given that trend unemployment has been about 23%, I know the crisis has raised it by a couple of percentage points, and we know that the discouraged worker effect leads to an even higher level of unemployment. But even if we just take registered unemployment at 25%, say a quarter of the labor force, that's a very high number of people who are clearly not participating in the growth process. They're only participating in the social transfer process. So, and surely society, any society, owes it to all of its people to offer them an opportunity to participate in growth. I say opportunity, then whether they can take up the opportunity is a second issue. But surely society has to do that. And 25% of the labor force not participating in growth may well account for the fact that this is a transfer effect which is affecting poverty, but that these people are not participating in growth. I want to then quickly lead to
one other indicator of poverty, of inequality, which might be interesting to look at, and that is, of course, the share of the distribution of the total GDP between wages on the one hand and profits on the other hand. That may well be an area where Professor Borat has already worked on, but I think it is important, especially to bring in the global debate. The global debate now, Minister Patel just pointed out that some of the IMO's work points to the fact that income inequalities have worsened. To add to that, we have a very large wage report which has been published just recently, and it comes on top of further evidence. Let me quickly summarize the evidence. This is evidence by the World Bank and by the IMF that in the last two decades, the wage share, the share earned by wage workers, has gone down in a significant number of countries for which good data is available, which means the profit share earned by capital has gone up. Now, this is not a very simple fact, because in it is a little bit of a mix-up, which is that the world does not consist of only wage workers and profit earners. There is a large group of the self-employed. And at the moment, this kind of result is not a very satisfactory result for very precise academics like Professor Borat, myself as well, because arbitrarily half the income of the self-employed is given to wage workers, is given to the wage share. That, therefore, for me, is not a very good result. But I think the ILO has gone beyond that and looked at what is a very simple relationship between wages and productivity. For productivity, the ILO has taken a proxy of GDP per capita and then looked at what happens to the wage vis-a-vis labor productivity, vis-a-vis GDP per capita. It's looked at 70 countries over the last two decades and finds that for each, perhaps the best way to present the result is, for each percentage increase in GDP, real wages increase by less than 1%, they increase by 0.75%, 0.75%. Now, this result doesn't get into the problem of self-employment incomes, etc. This is a very, very important result to be, I'm trying to sort of put this forward because Minister Patel raised the broader issues of inequalities around the world. Clearly, the whole world has been going in the same direction that South Africa is going as well, which is not good, because let me sum up by pointing out a fairly simple position on inequalities would be that, look, if we had perfect equality, then that may not be a great idea, because there would not be any incentive for people to acquire skills and therefore become more skilled, therefore increase their productivity, and therefore lead to technical change. So we would want perhaps just a little bit of inequality. But on the other hand, we have found through our work in the more unequal societies like Brazil, where the Gini coefficient verges on 0.63, 0.64, that it becomes counterproductive to investment. Because as inequality has grown up so high, security of capital becomes lower, and therefore investment levels suffer very badly. Which is why I began by saying I don't want to prejudge the issue of inequality, but clearly a sensible policy choice has to be based upon these two extremes. Just a little bit of inequality is needed to encourage productivity, but very high levels of productivity will discourage investment, will discourage growth, will discourage employment, and that trajectory. But I've taken up too much time, Minister Patel. Let me stop there.
Well, thank you very much, Martin. I think everybody would agree that really these are two quite interesting sets of reflections, and particularly Professor Borat's data. And I'd like to open the discussion in the policy implications of this. But perhaps by way of a very brief summary, what are the results that Professor Borat is asking us to look at? So one is that poverty has declined in the period 1995 to 2005. And as he indicates from the income and expenditure survey, this is quite an important outcome. The second one is that absolute levels of poverty remain high, at about 50% of the population, if you measure it, say, by the 322 rand per month expenditure based on the headcount index. There's still high levels of poverty. He says that race and gender still is critically associated with poverty. And then on income inequality, there's a few observations that income inequality is rising and is very, very high by international standards. We were thinking of a formulation that is technically correct, and it looks like the formulation that it is certainly of the highest in any industrializing economy. The inequality between whites and Africans is driving the overall increase. He calls the results provisional because it's so counterintuitive and inconsistent with much of the public commentary. But if true, if confirmed in further investigation, it's quite a significant outcome. He says that since 1995, a disproportionate share of economic growth has gone to the top end of the income band, and that social transfer programs have been a key source of rising incomes at the bottom end of the income band. And finally, he's made the point that based on the evidence, we're entrenching our reputation as a very unequal society. What Mazen has reflected on, is, aside from his comments on the paper, has drawn attention to the international trends, particularly the one that shows a declining share of national income across a number of countries to wages, and that wage performance has lagged aggregate productivity growth, by which we use the proxy of GDP growth, the GDP per capita growth. And in a way, conceptually, what the question is, are we seeing outcomes, market outcomes, based on the economic activities over the last couple of years of rising inequality, with state interventions that partially but not completely mitigate the effect on inequality? What are the policy issues? The G20 meeting of heads of state have examined one part of the inequality issue, which is executive pay, particularly executive pay within the banking or financial sector. And a number of countries are now saying that governments need to find an appropriate policy role in this area. What are some of the other policy questions that the two contributions raise? To what extent does labour market absorption rates explain some or all of this? What about distribution of income issues? Does the rising precariousness of work, the fact that the quality of employment is a challenge in big parts of the economy, contribute? And what about earnings at the top? And finally, is there any explanation that can be given for shifts in the sectoral structure of the economy? So those are some of the issues that directly and indirectly the speakers are putting to us. There's an opportunity now to ask them, particularly to ask Professor Borat, to talk about the evidence. But I'm also going to encourage colleagues to put forward what you believe to be policy suggestions and ideas that parliamentarians and government should consider. And the floor is now open. If you'd be kind enough to introduce yourself when you ask a question or make a comment. I have a hand right at the back.
Thanks, Minister. Thanks, Professor Borat. My name is Moiti Khamanya, and I'm from the Department of Transport. I've got two questions. The first question, Professor, is that besides public expenditure programs, which I think significantly have contributed to positive economic growth within the last decade. What are the other driving factors that contributed to that positive economic growth? Which then also leads to my second question, that evidently because of government policy there's been an emergence of a strong black middle class, but also anecdotally there's also been the emergence of the poorer white household. I don't know what evidence we can share into that, because we've had reports of a number of white-headed households and male-headed households which have become poorer within the last decade or so, and how significant that has what significance has that had on the shift in terms of race inequality in South Africa. Lastly, as a suggestion, maybe because of concerted government public expenditure programs to alleviate poverty, as a policy challenge, we might want to look at the effectiveness of the social welfare system as a form of income in addressing poverty alleviation, but also income inequality. Whether has that actually addressed the concerns that it was aimed at addressing? Thank you.
Okay, perhaps we should take two or three questions in clusters. Deputy Minister, have the floor.
I'm Derek Hanekom. I'm an ANC Member of Parliament. I thought the presentation, although I didn't get all of it, I thought it was extremely useful, and I think that it helps us focus our minds and understand what's happening better, and I think we need more of it so that we understand even better what's happening, and we need to be able to analyse the results. But it would seem to me, Chairperson, that the it would be unsurprising that a significant number of the many very poor people are less poor, because of the significant expansion of the numbers of people on social grants and the increase of those social grants. So it would mean that less people are very poor because so many more people are receiving the grant. But then that very poor category, if you like, would surely be, because the question was asked, surely be those people who do not have jobs nor receive grants and therefore have no income whatsoever. And that poses a serious challenge. It seems a question about whether some people then are excluded from growth. Well, that's also self-evident, yes. So those who have not achieved managed to get jobs as a result of growth, and those that have not gone onto the grant system, because the grant system has certainly benefited from growth, more money available to put more people on the system than to give them more. But for those people not on the grant system, well, they haven't benefited from growth. That's self-evident. The chair, then, the policy question and a question in terms of measurement that I would like to put is, well, obviously, how do we focus our energy more on the very poor and get the very poor out of that poverty? If one were to introduce, for example, measures to address at least one of the basic needs, such as food and food access, and have household food security programs, that would indeed help. And I'm sure nobody here would deny the importance of having a national effort to ensure that at least we have no hungry people in our country. How would that, if a significant food security program were introduced consisting both of giving support to some of the very poorest who are subsistence farmers, if you like, who are on a bit of land but are unable to use that land and are able to use that land better, combined with measures such as food gardens, combined with measures such as soup kitchens, where significant numbers of people would have access to food, how does that get measured in terms of inequality? Because surely then you've lessened the very worst effects of severe poverty. Is that measurable?
Another Member of Parliament, you have the floor.
Thank you. Long Training from the ID. I think both presentations were extremely enlightening. You've described the effect that the growth trajectory has had on inequality. I'd just be interested to know the effect that inequality has had on our growth trajectory. And I say that because a number of economists, in fact, looking at the global financial crisis, have in fact put one of the structural reasons for this global financial crisis as the kind of growing inequality, because in fact the people are not able to keep up with the aggregate demand in terms of purchasing goods, because the purchasing power is going down. To what extent has that played a role in South Africa? Because if I look at that, if the top 20% income is growing rapidly, what is that income being spent on? Is that being spent on imported consumer goods? And if we had to create a more equal society, would that also change our growth trajectory and the kind of composition of demand in South Africa?
Maybe a final question in the first cluster.
Thank you. I'm Ivan Abramsa from COSATU. I wanted to check. I know you, it's a broad paper, but where are we beginning to understand the gap or the income differential between rural, urban, in particular, you know, perhaps on a geographical or regional sense, the former Bantustan and the metropolitan areas and particular aspect, which areas of the country are more unequal. The other question I wanted to ask, you've mentioned that you would have expected a significant event to have changed the Gini coefficient to the extent that it has changed. And I wanted us to look at that. What has it been that has led to such a drastic change? And what kind of measures do we see being able to begin to change it to a more equitable society? I mean, are we talking about universal literacy, stuff like that? Because if I understand it, the colonial economy is still reproducing itself. If we are remaining more unequal after 10 years, we don't see a turnaround. Instead, we're seeing an entrenchment of inequality. You know, it really asks the question that are we going to be able to proceed with, and I'm not talking about just social grants, I think the sustainability of that is quite clear, but the economic system which tends to sideline a large proportion of the population in a systematic way. Thanks.
How many speakers? 1, 2, 3, 4 speakers with about 17 questions. I'll try and cover them broadly, so apologies that I haven't touched all the questions. I mean, what are the factors that caused growth post-94? Papers out there that deal with it much better than I could. But everything that you'd expect that would come with a if you like, a political windfall. In other words, South Africa enters the democratic world, and so export markets open up, FDI enters, new investment markets, we become a tradable currency again, we're back on the map of emerging economies in terms of how asset managers see South Africa and so on. So there are lots of triggers for our growth process. The evidence that, around poor whites, you've got to remember that the evidence that we base this analysis on, and it's the only evidence we have, is 30,000 households, right? So 30,000 households, although it's statistically representative and it's robust as far as possible, it means that when you start asking, well, how many Asian males who have a university education living in the Free State are poor, you're not going to get that kind of data from this kind of data set, just because it's at quite a high level of aggregation. So in the same way, picking up the incidence of poor whites, I would look at that data, but I wouldn't be too trustworthy of it, just because the sample size is so small. Having said that, I wouldn't have expected, even if we did have a decent sample, not that the sample is problematic, but if you had a sample of only whites, for example, in the society, I wouldn't have expected the impact on inequality or poverty to have been dramatic anyway with poor whites. Yes, I should have said that social grants, social transfers are globally, right, and South Africa is no exception, shown to be the most effective poverty alleviation instrument you have. That's not unimportant, right? So basically, if you want to reach the poor, spend it on social grants. There's no question about that. Now, of course, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's a growth and development strategy. And I think that's where the debate is being centered on the fact that you can't run a growth and development strategy that's based on, as we said, you know, trickling down in the form of social grants. It's not sustainable, nor is it necessarily desirable. The Deputy Minister's question, okay, let me take the second one. I wasn't sure I understood the first one, but the second one, food security programs, your question was, is it measurable? Well, through a survey such as this, it would be, because the survey asks individuals, what did you consume? So if there's a school feeding program or and the household has consumed off that program, that would be recorded in the survey. So you would pick it up. For me, one of the big debates globally that's been going on around the impact of the recession is what are the big wins that can be had out of, in terms of low cost but big wins for assisting the poor as a consequence of the recession. Food security has been one of those. The whole argument that when a person loses his or her job in the household, right, the first effect is on the child who goes hungry, and the consequences in the long run, right, in terms of development of the brain and so on, are just almost, it's very difficult to actually claw that back. And so getting food security into those households, the Mexican government does, right, is a very effective instrument for dealing with the consequences of a recession. But it doesn't necessarily have to be for a recession only, and I think that is the point. The story about jobs and grants. Now, one of the difficulties with the data, again, is I can't go into that bottom of the distribution and tell you the makeup of that household. That's really what you want to know. What's the proportion of grantees versus those people who are unemployed and so on? The data isn't set up. That's the problem. My guess would be, though, that it won't necessarily be, the poorest won't necessarily be people who have a combination of no jobs and no grants. I think, remember, the grantees, if you have a child support grant and there's no other income, you're still technically poor, right? So, and again, so that depends on where you set the poverty line, of course. That's the sneaky little footnote that you've got to figure out. But you can have child support grantees, no old age pensioner, right? And it's classic, it's an unemployed young woman, right, who gets a child support grant but is looking after three children. She's technically poor. So grants are part of the issue in terms of solving the poverty problem, but it's not a guarantee. And that's important to keep in mind. The question about inequality's impact on growth, others may want to come in on the composition of demand and so on in terms of other countries, but the it's an interesting question. So, essentially, it's about have consumption patterns forced a certain growth path because it's based on those at the top end. I think that must be part of the story. So it must be true that the nature of demand forces a certain structure of supply, right? Which is essentially whether it's imported or domestically made. Now, that's a very clever question, actually. I mean, in a way, what it means is that changing the structure of the economy would necessitate changing the composition of demand such that it's more representative of the population. And you can think of demand for automobiles, for example, right, being one example, or being one case where you're changing the composition of demand and suddenly you've got a much bigger market for a product that wasn't there. However, I do think that the more important story about inequality and growth is really about how, when you have a growth process that results in sharing of the organic fruits of growth amongst a smaller part of the population, right, the problem is that that becomes bad for growth itself. And that's the key thing, right? That too high a unequal growth path, if you like, is bad business for growth. The question about, from Ivan, there were two, about urban and rural areas. Yeah, we don't have enough detail, again, the survey is not great on location, but certainly there is evidence to suggest that urban inequalities have grown, right? So it's not strictly based on this data. And that's partly because people have been migrating from poorer provinces into cities, right, and are jobless. So you get these zero earners stacked up in urban areas and they're growing. And so income distribution within urban areas is actually growing. And that then speaks to what you do within rural areas and so on. So there's evidence there. It's a very good question about what has been the big change, right? If you see income inequality only changing so much by such dramatic, to such a dramatic degree, if you have a shock event, what is the shock event? That's a great question. For me, it's the only thing I can make sense of is that you have a growth process that was so unusual post 94 because of 94. So in other words, South Africa suddenly opens up, markets open up. We now classified as an emerging market, and within this shock event, if you like, we completely understandably as a society are unable to manage the organic growth process. And so you see that those who are most educated, those who are most networked, those who are able to access state tenders, those who are able to access growing sectors such as services industries and so on, are those who gain from growth. And even though the state has tried an income sense of social grants, so that the net result is rising income inequality. Let me just end off by saying that I did note the story about this being principally about income. Remember, there's another story going on parallel to this between 95 and 2005 around housing, water, electricity, right? And there you see massive improvements. So on the non-income poverty and non-income inequality side, there's actually been a reduction in both poverty and inequality. And that's another strand of work which we've done. So non-income inequality actually went down. The non-income Gini goes down, right? And that's not unimportant, actually, in the context of this broader debate about growth, poverty, and inequality.
Martin. Thank you, Minister. If I may address a very quick point issue raised by the Minister. The IMO has found that, of course, it stresses social transfers, protection for the vulnerable, absolutely critical. The question is that, on the one hand, you have the high-income societies, the high-income economies, the advanced economies that can afford the large transfers. Does that mean economies that do not have the fiscal space, for example, in the middle of this current crisis, what do those economies do? And an answer has been provided by the very brilliant innovative scheme coming out of India called the National Rural Employment Guarantee Act, which says very simply that we need to have the transfers, we need to protect the vulnerable, the people. But if we do not have sufficient income, like the advanced economies, then let us give them a job and use their labor at the minimum wage towards developing infrastructure. And that is an absolutely brilliant scheme, and that is something that we in the ILO are now pushing as a form, not as a substitute for social protection, but certainly as providing a modicum of social cover, especially in times of crisis, because these are not long-term jobs. Typically, they would be providing one household 100 days in the year at the minimum wage. But this is a very good way to look at it. I would like to quickly address the issue by the Honourable Member about consumption and about aggregate demand. Again, the issue is that certainly where we're looking at it from the point of view of the ILO, part of the crisis seems to be engendered by a weakness in wages, which has led to a weakness in demand, aggregate demand, in particular economies, which has then had to be, in the interest of raising aggregate demand, credit has stepped in. And if you get credit to step in, where people's incomes are weak, you get, by definition, the subprime crisis. So therefore, that is one part of the imbalances, where you get high levels of consumption supported by credit, for example, as in the US. But equally, there is another part of the story, which is a economy with large surpluses in export surpluses like China, where consumption has also been weakened over time, and this I'm now using World Bank data to show that the share of consumption has gone down over time and the share of savings has gone up, and those savings have then been recycled in terms of investment abroad. So the issue of balances between consumption and savings is a critical one. I'm not saying that South Africa falls into either the one or the other, but it is symptomatic and it is interesting to consider as a policy question how you want consumption. At the simplest level, you want consumption to provide the domestic market just as exports provide the external market. And the crisis shows you want a balance between them, because you cannot rely upon the golden age of exports continuing in perpetuity.
Thank you. We take another round of questions. If I can just get an indication, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, Minister. I just understanding, obviously, that the world is in an economic crisis in South Africa, and there is a lot of emphasis on policy and interventions. And I know that, obviously, my name is Patrick Perry, and I represent the Western Cape Regional Opportunities Forum. And the challenge, even one of the challenges that we face is to look at the current economic structure, and then the worldwide attention is given to that in terms of restructuring our economy, and look at how you can also in terms of and more specifically looking at how can we put the emphasis on wealth creation through your SME sector. Now South Africa is known, it's where we're giving our part in terms of that gap. And I believe that the Italian economy is probably one of the better examples of that. Isn't there somehow a need that, and I know that when we got our democracy, there was a small business conference, and I know there was a lot of attempts. Isn't that where, in order for a more long-term solution, that more serious consideration should be given in terms of how can we deal with that component of our economy to establish a strong small and medium sector, business sector? I just want to get a view maybe on that. I mean, as I say, I'm involved with the international initiative, where the time when we started is to establish what's called a social responsible local venture capital fund type of concept. Because through that, if there's instruments in place to, in a very structured manner, respond to that, so that in a more longer term, we might be able to deal with the job creation, wealth creation, then obviously the distribution of wealth. Thank you.
Thank you. You have the floor.
Thank you, Minister. My name is Jan Swartz. I represent the WECBOF, Western Cape Business Opportunity Forum. In the first place, which I wanted to know, as you did mention, Africans and whites. The first definition was white and black. On the moment, I don't know under who I'm falling, under African or under white, and who is the lowest group, I don't know. But what concerns business, I represent especially business, in particular transport. For the previous disadvantaged bus operators. The inequality which we know which is in that sector, which is 40 years back, and especially in the Western Cape, which this previous disadvantaged bus operators which have a very bad deal. We were there before anybody was even thinking about transport. We transport our communities with horse and car, buses, lorries, till the buses comes in. We are still there. We need to improve on our own steam with nothing from government side. We transport our communities to, otherwise it was dead satellite towns if we wasn't there. We need to transport the churches, the schools, the youth clubs, sports clubs. we was looking so much forward, very much when 1996 comes in and we did say yes, we're here, we are now. There was only one big operator in the Western Cape, which the only one which did get subsidies from government, and up to now, for the last 40 years, it's only that company. He has a new DRP system rolling out, and what they say now to us, only the previous operators will be able to join into that. We are previous operators, but we were never under the subsidy scheme, and they should...
Well, Mr. Speaker, just to link that to the presentation and perhaps in the form of a question or a proposal.
Yes, that one, what is, and I feel it's the only thing which government can lead us out of that position, so that we be part of the structure which is forward. In connection with the clothing industry, which is in front of us and which a lot of our small manufacturers suffering all the years, we were never allowed to trade in the mainstream of the business because we were being pushing out of town. We got to trade in our neighbor areas where we did stay, and that did bring us. Up to now, government did do nothing to that. They building the big malls, which the rentals is so high, no one of our smaller smaller manufacturers can participate into that deal. We are still left out. That's why you find so many informal traders on the streets. We still trade on the streets because government doesn't. The government of before they put us out, and I feel it is the government which got to put us in, but they don't touch it. They just look at the poverty. Where do the poverty come from? It's not to be said that we couldn't do it. We could have been the same. Then another thing, government comes with the empowerment structure. They expect me as a black businessman to empower other people. I must empower women, I must empower youth, I must empower disabled. Well, I was never being empowered. How can we? Thank you.
Thank you. Next to you is the next speaker, followed by you, sir.
Yes, my name is Sidney Khar. I'm from Kosat. I just wanted to ask a question to the speaker from the IMF. You refer to a study by the IMF and the World Bank that indicates that globally, in the context of the growth that has been happening today, the capital has taken a larger share of the growth. And so the implication of this, and also what you had said in response to the paper by Haroon, was that this pattern of growth appears to be international. The question, firstly, I'd like to know what the IMF and World Bank are then saying in response to this, how to change this pattern of growth, if there's any policy proposal arising out of their findings, but in part, arguably, this was also the outcomes of some of their policy proposals in some parts of the world. And then there's a related question to Haroon. Currently, we are spending something to the tune of 800 billion or more on infrastructure, which was part of the ESA program. And the target then was to achieve a growth rate of about 6% and later, you know, to increase a little bit more than that. And in terms of what you were dealing with between 1995 and 2005, as you said, on average of about 3.5%. So does it mean that even when you can achieve 6% growth rate, as long as there's no structural change in the pattern of growth, it will remain skewed and it will reproduce the current historical inequalities in terms of gender, race, and class. So, or is it, would that level of growth be perhaps dependent on some change in the composition of
of industrial development.
Yes, for sure.
Thank you very much, Minister Patel. Firstly, may I tender an excuse on behalf of my colleague, we had to run into a teleconference that was supposed to start at 3. Fortunately, when we got there, the people were no longer available. My name is Wiseman Makassel. I'm from the National Department of Social Development. I had, with my colleague here, a program in the department that is called the Social Policy Program, whose main objective really is to make sure that as a department we have effective policies that we develop. I would like to address my observations primarily to Professor Harold Borat. The first one really relates to the issue of poverty lines that he displayed, which also are used in South Africa by Statistics South Africa. And also, secondly, I want to somewhat make some comment as well on the issue of the rise of absolute numbers of South Africans who are in receipt of one form of a social grant or the other. Now, question really is that when you look at the poverty line that was shown, which is 322 rand per month per adult, question really that comes to the fore is the following. How helpful are these poverty lines? What is it really that they tell us? Can we, in all sense, really say that somebody who earns even double that 322 rand poverty line, who's an adult, is out of poverty in South Africa, currently as we speak? What I'm trying to bring to the fore here is the following. We need, I think, as a country, to guard against chasing obstructions that do not have any relation to reality on the ground. There are many countries in the world, England really, who has got a very, very long tradition of poverty studies. It has happened that once they thought that they had dealt with poverty, in terms of the so-called absolute minimalist poverty lines that were used to measure poverty, they actually discovered that many of their people were in deep extreme poverty, denied quite a number of things that British society over decades had assumed that each and every member of that society had access to. The same thing has happened in Morocco, the same thing has happened in Australia. So what then happened is the following. Ourselves as government, we are going to reduce the numbers of people who are at this poverty line, 322 rand per month, only to find that, on investigation, there are many South Africans who are in worse forms of poverty. That's the first, I think, observation, which I do think is an important one. A second issue, Professor Borat, with a number of other researchers on poverty in the country, could you begin to state what components in actual items are assumed under this poverty line? In other words, if you say 322 rand per month for an adult is a poverty line, it is not just a money metric poverty line. It's money metric because it's based on an assumed consumption or expenditure. Often these poverty lines will have what is called a food component and non-food component. What are assumed? How do you arrive at the 322? That would help, because when you really look at it, 322 rand a month could buy approximately about 40 loaves per month. And as you know, men, I'm sure it extends to women as well, can't live on bread alone, as they say. Now, so this would assist quite a great deal if what is assumed as consumption and specific items under this poverty line. The second point, as I've mentioned earlier, that I really would like to look at is the rise of the number of social grant beneficiaries. And I want to relate it to the very last comment that Professor Borat made. Is this sustainable? I'm not going to answer that, but I'm going to say the following. Currently, as we speak, 27% of the South African population
estimated at 49.5 million are in receipts of one form or the other of a social grant. The overall numbers by the end of June 2009 was actually 13.4 million South Africans. Now, when you really look at it, so long as there are policy failures in other areas, we will have a rising demand for social grants in South Africa. So long as our economy does not absorb labor and provide South Africans with, for want of a better term or phrase, living wages, we will have this kind of a problem. Failures in other parts of our policies, primarily economic policy, primarily labor policy, will mean that numbers of people that require social grants will increase. That's the first, I think, observation I'd like to make on the issue of the numbers of social grant recipients. The second one is the issue of, is this sustainable? It is not a fair question to ask and ask in that manner. A more proper way of asking the question is the following. Firstly, the tendency tends to be to look at this issue from a fiscal perspective. You know, it's 4.3% of GDP. But what we need to ask ourselves as a country, primarily as government, is the following. What are we buying with these social grants? It is only then that we can be able to say or ask the question, are they sustainable or not? Now, when you look at the sorts of things that the old age pension buys for poor South Africans in the country, the child support grant, what these various grants actually buy for us as a country. It's better nutritional status for children, it's school attendance, it's a whole list of very, very positive things that are happening that have been proven by different types and kinds of research in the country. So before we say, are these sustainable, we need to ask ourselves, what are these social grants actually, buying for us, as a country? And question also is this. When we ask the question of sustainable, we need also to factor in the political issue. What will be the political risk if we did not have these social grants? In other words, what are the costs to the country if we did not have these social grants? So I really would like that this kind of perspective and thinking of sustainability is looked at a much more broader and much more contextualized level rather than purely from a fiscal perspective. Last, please, with your indulgence, Minister Patel is really following. We started constructing the anti-poverty strategy in the country. I was part of the task team. And Cabinet instructed us that the social cluster and the economic cluster must come together. This is what happened in our first meeting. Our colleagues from the economic cluster saw the problem of poverty and unemployment. You address high levels of unemployment, you have solved the problem. We looked at it differently. We looked at it as quality early childhood development that builds young people in environments that are intellectually stimulating, where their nutrition is taken care of, building up to quality health, building up to quality education, building the human resources of the country. And then you will offset the kind of problems that the country faces that are called poverty. It was very interesting to look at the different perspectives and orientations. It doesn't mean that we disagreed with them when they said the problem is unemployment. We rather took a much more broader, much more contextualized perspective and understanding of issues of poverty than they did. Thank you very much. Just wanted to make those kind of observations.
Thank you for that. I see a last request for the floor. Seeing no further requests, two more, and then we'll give the speakers an opportunity to have the floor.
Thank you, Corporate Minister. My daughter, Sambata, from COSATU. The first question is whether there's any correlation between wage settlements on a similar percentage increment across wage bands. and the element of rising inequality within race groups. The second one would be the economic whether there's any correlation between the economic deracialization, the BEE, it's more of an economic deracialization. Now, on economic deracialization and the ownership of the means of production, whether there's no correlation in terms of the contribution to the growing inequality by race. The third one, which may be controversial, income inequality, where there's no evidence in an economic system, where the system itself does not breed inequality. We would be talking about a growing gap of inequality, only to find that the central problem is the system. Well, there's no evidence that proves that the system breeds inequality, as a matter of fact. The last one, which may also be controversial, it's around whether you have not checked poverty line per month on human beings, ourselves, and animal feed per month in terms of the relation. Whether these 322 rand per person would be the same 322 rand per head of a cow to be fed per month. Whether there's not a disparity both in developing and developed world in this instance, because at one time there was a research that confirmed that in the developed world there was almost 200 rand per day to feed a cow a day, whereas it was not the same with a person per day in terms of affordability. Thanks.
Thank you. That gives me the pleasure of inviting the last question or comment or policy proposal. Yes, sir. Is there a microphone in there that you can use? Okay.
At that time, just before they received the capital outflow of 90 billion rand. And we in the ANC have been involved in that issue with the fund that cost us 100 billion rand to eliminate the housing shortage. But in so far as the economic growth is concerned, and you raise the question of FDI, what impact has the disinvestment in this country by our own large domestic corporations like Anglo, Old Mutual, Investec, had an economic growth and could it have been better? And if we had a patriotic, you know, being this country, or a patriotic capitalist class, in the form of Anglo and Old Mutual, and not asking this in a controversial sense, would the economic growth have been higher? And then my last question is, before it's sufficiently obvious that the people who are hungry in our country and who are homeless on our streets are of predominant people, are we able, even given the current economic catastrophe that the world is experiencing, in South Africa particularly, are we able to narrow those gaps by addressing the issue of race? In other words, is racism in our country and in our country particularly the direct cause of those inequalities that are the
Okay, I'm going to ask the two speakers to respond to what has been a mix of questions, proposals, reflections on the issues that they've raised. And they may also want to use the opportunity to make a brief concluding comment. And can I ask Haroon Borat first to have the floor?
I think some of the questions are best dealt with by the minister rather than me. I'll give a shot. The infrastructure expenditure story about if we reach a target of 6%, would we still have seen the same outcomes? And the answer is yes. But the whole point is that it's not so much the level of growth that you attain, but the trajectory, the nature of that growth. And that's the danger. So in other words, you could have reached 6%. Well, we did reach in one quarter, we reached 6% growth, right? But if the structure still sees the better skilled or the better educated or the better network or certain sectors that are highly skilled, that speaks to the industrial strategy issue, that gain from growth, then you're still going to get the outcomes that we saw. And so that's a key story. And incidentally, that relates to the first question, which is true, that part of the argument that I've made informally, but the data, it's hard to make the argument yet with the data, is that a key part of our changing our growth trajectory has to be the small business sector or has to be the informal sector. South Africa stands out as one of the few developing countries which have such a small informal economy. I've said it many, many times before, it's the only place where you have to go into a shop, park your car, go into a shopping mall, take a lift to buy deodorant, right? Most other parts of the developing world, you go across the street and you buy it from a street trader. That speaks to sort of structural rigidities in the economy. So Wiseman was being naughty, because he's been a part of these discussions for a long time about poverty lines and so on. So he should know all this, right? Poverty lines are standard methodology used all over the world, developing countries, developed countries. It's a standard methodology. And it's precisely the debate that we just heard about, well, what does 322 mean? It's precisely because of that that we have these guys here. That's why those guys are important. That graph there, where we use the black lines are those poverty lines. And all that tells you is that doesn't matter which poverty line you use. That's the important result, right, Wiseman? That it didn't matter which poverty line you use, that you still saw a decline in poverty. That does not mean, though, right, and that's where... And I'll come back to why poverty lines are still used. That does not mean, though, that you're placing a normative view that this person is necessarily now, when they move above 322. Can you normatively say, subjectively say, aha, you are now not poor any longer? Of course not. I think that would be crazy, right? So why do we use the poverty lines? Well, because we need an organizing framework so that ministers, so that senior technocrats and so on, have a sense of what is happening, what's and all, using different poverty lines, using the things that I prefer, poverty analysis without poverty lines, to show what's actually happening to
poor households in society. So I think that's more where the debate should be, rather than whether you should have a poverty line or not. Poverty lines are used all over the world, all the time. Make sure you use more than one poverty line. Make sure that you complement it with analysis of poverty without poverty lines. And thirdly, make sure that you don't assume that if somebody immediately moves above a poverty line, that they're suddenly non-poor. And so, as Wiseman knows, because we did the background paper for his department, the poverty line structure is what it is. 2,100 kilojoules, which is the food component, which is what makes you, in terms of energy levels, at an appropriate level. And then there's a non-food component. And there are different ways of doing it. And there's a literature out there, and there are debates out there. And it's all very boring if you don't really like statistical measurement, but it's fairly procedural in setting or in suggesting, right? In suggesting where a poverty line could be based on scientific methods as far as you can go with them, right, in as transparent a way as possible. The choice then, and that's again globally what happens, the choice of where you set the poverty line is not the scientist's choice. It's not the economist's choice. Right? It's the society's choice, and it's usually done either with social partners together or politicians alone. It doesn't matter. In India, all the social partners get together and they fight like hell and they set a poverty line. But in the background, you have the scientific evidence which says, well, it should be at this level or that level, and then there's a debate. And then on the sustainability story, I think that's right. I think the story really is about, is it a sustainable growth path? That was the story, right? But in other words, what you're doing is taking your revenue base, right, and propping it at the bottom end of the distribution through social grants. Social grants must be part of the story, right? The issue really is that a growth path that you think is preferable to, for example, an employment-absorbing growth path, an industrial strategy that opens greater employment opportunities for people. And that's the extent to which one needs to question, not on the fiscal space story, but on the sustainability in terms of a growth and development path. That is the issue. I think Wiseman's alluding to the constant debates between DSP and Treasury, and I presume those are still ongoing. I think that Madora's point about wage inequality is a very, very insightful one. Mainly because overall inequality in the society, and it's true because the other work on the Gini coefficient, which is decomposed by income source, shows that the biggest contributor to the Gini coefficient, right, is in fact wage income. And so therefore wage inequality, and, as you said, right, what did you say, the correlation between wage settlements across the band, right? And so therefore it would make sense that you've seen greater returns to income, right? In other words, greater wage increases to those at the top end relative to those at the bottom end, and that stretches the distribution. So, and that partly talks to the middle of the distribution and the top, because you've got social grants coming in at the bottom end, right? And that's key, right? So wage inequality has been a big part of the story of overall rising inequality. And I think it's also true that if you look at economic deracialization, BEE, and ownership of capital, that's also true. I think that covers it. I just wanted to end this question. I actually don't have an answer on the capital outflows. I mean, that's a very technical area. I do know that the response would be, well, there are capital outflows, but they're dual listings, and then there's local shareholders and foreign shareholders. The counter argument would also be, is you've got to be tradable as a company, right? So that you can have foreign shareholders holding South African assets and those sorts of things. The extent to which you look at inflows and outflows, and whether you have hurdles in terms of ability to move out your foreign holdings as quickly as you would like to, is again another technical debate about carbon taxes and stuff. But they're certainly worth examining, especially if you look at the financial crisis. I think that sort of covers it. I guess
given the discussion around growth, poverty, and inequality, one doesn't want to lose that around lose that part of the debate, that our growth part, even though it's been pro-core, even though it's been positive, and that's sort of my concluding comment, that even though all parts of the distribution have gained, it's very clear that it's individuals at the top end who've gained far more, and that feeds into this rising income inequality story.
Thank you, and I'm going to ask Mazen Mahmoud to respond to some of the issues that have come up in the discussion and to make a concluding comment.
Perhaps I won't. They were not very. I thought that there were two issues that needed, if you like, a little bit of a closure, as much as we have come to a closure at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. One is that the story about poverty, in ILO's humble experience, is a very complex one. And, you know, there's a whole dynamic in any economy that's happening. And there are amazingly different processes working out. But certainly the commonalities are, one, the point that Professor Borat has pointed out, that transfers do significantly affect poverty. But another issue that we have found affects poverty is the transfers you cannot see, which are the subsidies. Now, if you have a subsidy on a wage good, that is a very critical component of poverty. And between two diverse countries as Pakistan on the one hand and Sudan on the other hand, when policy advice came in to reduce subsidies, which means raise the prices of particular public products, such as electricity, but also such as subsidies that go into wage goods, also others like wheat or rice or oils, palm oils, etc., edible oils. It significantly affected poverty in two diverse countries, one in Asia, one in Africa. A second scenario is a much more complex one. For example, in Nepal, the ILO found that poverty increased based upon a very complex combination of trade liberalization and phasing out of subsidies. Not that either one was bad, but the sequencing and the coincidence was such that the government chose to phase out subsidies to agriculture at the same time as it liberalized trade in agriculture and unfortunately imported poverty because the peasantry simply got pauperized and as a result went Maoist. There is a very clear correlation. So poverty obviously is amazingly complex at the circumstances, but I think there was a specific question addressed about inequality and the report. I wanted to repeat that so we are not misquoted. The IMF and the World Bank have both shown that the wage shares have declined in the previous two decades in a large number of countries for which there is data. I remember off the top of my head the study by the IMF is by Gusina. I can send you the reference for the World Bank study. But let me stop there.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much to both of our speakers for sharing with us the experience and for responding with insight to some of the difficult challenges and questions that you've put to them. I guess from the Economic Development Ministry and Department point of view, what we want to achieve with a series of public discussions, and this is one of a number that we are holding, is to open up the debate and to ensure that the information on which government will make its policy determinations is information that is in the public domain. So when we receive Harun Borat's paper, which we read with great interest, it's important that business, organized labor, community organizations should have access to this. What are some of the policy issues that come out of the discussion?
The first clearly is the debate towards the end that's taken place now on the value of an official poverty line. And we'll need to think through that as government. And perhaps the most important issue here is that what government looks for is some way of measuring impact and seeing trends and developments over time. So however we resolve the issue of whether there should be an official poverty line, clearly having some proxy, some way of approximating the complex reality of a society over time, helps us to see what the impact and effects are of either policies or of the external effects on our economy. So that conversation will continue. I'd like to draw to four relationships that you identified in some way or the other with your questions, or the two presenters did in their replies. The first relationship is that between the role of social policy, the mitigating impact, and that of economic policy, dealing with some of the structural roots of the effects that we are analyzing, whether it be poverty or inequality or unemployment. And whether the